Good morning. This is Walt Harrington. I'm here on Focus 580, and we're here to talk this morning with Juan Williams, who is the author of a new book called Enough: The Phony Leaders, Dead-End Movements, and Culture of Failure That Are Undermining Black America, and What Can We Do About It? A mouthful. Juan is a former reporter, 20 years for The Washington Post. He is a former White House reporter and correspondent for that newspaper. He is the author of Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, 1954 to 1965, Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary, This Far by Faith, Stories from the African-American Religious Experience, I'll Find a Way to Make One, A Tribute to Historically Black Colleges and Universities, and My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience. Juan is today a senior correspondent for National Public Radio and a commentator on Fox News. Juan, welcome, and thanks for being with us today.
Walt, my pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me on the show this morning.
Sure, glad to. A little truth in advertising. Juan and I do go back a number of years. We shared an office once at the Washington Post magazine about two decades ago, and I invited Juan to come and kick off our Brown versus the Board of Education commemorative activities here on the campus 2 years ago, and he came and was the kickoff speaker for that event, and we're the kind of friends that stay in touch by phone at least once every 4 or 5 years, right, Ron?
Well, I had a great time when I came out. You know, I thought that was one of the better celebrations of Brown. It was done with some thought and care, and I appreciate it. Well,
we're glad you could come. When we're here today, really, in many ways, as a tangent of those events, back in 2004, Bill Cosby, the comic entertainer, black philanthropist, given more than $20 million to historically African-American colleges in the United States, gave what turned out to be a rather remarkable speech on the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. In the famous Constitution Hall, where black opera star Marian Anderson had sung in 1939 after the intervention of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's wife after she had been barred from singing, a night of amazing festivities and celebration of the Brown versus the Board of Education decision that desegregated America's schools in 1954. 3,000 black Americans in tuxedos and gowns, and the keynote speaker was Bill Cosby, who stood up and shocked the audience by breaking what Juan calls faith with the African-American agreement to keep secret about the flaws and failings and troubles of African-American life. Juan talks about how Bill Cosby called up and said, we have to come back to our self-help traditions. But that was not the language in which he put it. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Cosby said, these people, they opened doors. They gave us the rights, he said, of the former civil rights leaders. But today, ladies and gentlemen, our cities, we have 50% dropout rates among black men in our neighborhoods. We have the highest percentage of American racial groups with men in prison. No longer is a person embarrassed because she is pregnant without a husband. No longer is a boy considered an embarrassment if he tries to run away from being a father. Ladies and gentlemen, the lower economic and lower middle economic people are not holding their end of this deal. This brought applause in the audience that night, but later it brought a firestorm. It came to be called the pound cake speech because Bill Cosby said of men in prison, African Americans in prison, these are not political prisoners. These are people going around stealing Coca-Cola, people getting shot in the back of the head over a piece of pound cake. Then we all run out and are outraged, saying the cops shouldn't have shot him. What the hell was he doing with the pound cake in his hand? Juan, you must have started this book literally the day after that explosive speech was given.
You know, I wasn't there, Walt, but I got to tell you, that speech was so powerful that I didn't hear about the speech. I heard the echoes, and I heard the response. And the response was so angry, and it came from civil rights leadership. I remember reading a piece by Teddy Shaw, who's the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, in which he said that Bill Cosby really didn't understand the power of racism, the power of systemic racism, institutional racism, to oppress black people in America, and he was blaming the victim, and he was essentially empowering right-wing demagogues who didn't have the best interests of black people at heart. He was now giving them ammunition and saying that they have no responsibility for the plight of the black poor in America. That was followed up by people who went even farther. They started saying that Cosby was a self-hating black man. He was representative of a black bourgeois that was interested only in distancing themselves from the black poor. This kind of thing was, it even went to Cosby's career as an entertainer, that the Cliff Huxtable character that he played on The Cosby Show, the character he played in I Spy, that these were all middle-class black people, and he was always disparaging of poor black people, which is incredible given what you just said about how much support he has given to historically black colleges and universities, how he's always portrayed positive images of black people, spoken up in terms of causes. But all of a sudden, the attack dogs were out on Cosby. And so when I saw that, I thought, you know, there's something special here. Let me go and do what you just did, Walt, which is go and look at the speech. And, of course, the speech is so powerful in part because Cosby, as an entertainer, uses such vivid language, you know, the pound cake, the cokes. He talks about a mother seeing her son in the orange jumpsuit that's given to them by the prison system and saying, oh, my boy, what are they doing to my boy? And Cosby says, where were you when he was 2, when he was 8, when he was 18, when he got his first gun? You know, where's the father? He's asking these hard questions, and people are applauding. And yet, as I say afterwards, the attack dogs were out. They were just trying to take Cosby out, marginalize him, absolutely undo the power of it. And I decided I'd like to do some reporting, go back and see what's the substance of this speech, whether the substance of this speech was justified, and try to put some shape to it in the form of a book. And that's what Enough is about.
Well, one of the issues is that he was criticized after the talk for basically not having statistics to support what, as one of the critics called, just a crotchety old man spouting off.
Right.
And I assume that one of the things that you decided to do was that you were going to go out and put the real meat around the bones of his overview kind of angry argument.
No question. I mean, you look at something like crime, for example. We've been talking a little bit about crime, you know, why it's called the pound cake speech. And Cosby talks in the speech about crime and crime being an absolute cancer in the black community. Now, I don't think there's any doubt about that. But when he talks about acceptance of crime and excuses and rationalizations being made for crime and drug use, given the fact that there are so many African-Americans in jail, you know, and given the fact that so many of them are there on drug charges and the like, you say, well, you know, what's the reality? Well, the reality is black Americans are about 13% of the population, but they are people who account for 37%, Walt, of the violent crime, 54% of the arrests for robberies, 51% murders. And what you've got is a prison population in the country now that's almost 50% African-American.
Of course, the critics came back, Juan, and said these statistics show the disproportionate effect of racism on an entire world of people, and also police disproportionate enforcement of laws, unfair drug laws against African-Americans. I mean, these became the criticisms and the retorts to those figures, that the figures, in a sense, lie because they don't get at the, quote, root causes of these things.
I don't think the figures lie. Well, I think you can't argue with the figures. You can rationalize. You can say, well, wait a second, there's a disparity in terms of enforcement, that people go into the black community looking for this kind of activity. You know, drug use obviously is mostly white in the country because there are more white people than black people. So why is there such a large percentage of black people who get caught up on this? Are the police searching this out? But there's no question that this exists. And maybe the best evidence of it is that most of the victims of these robberies, murders, of the criminal activity are black people. I mean, it's famously told the story of Jesse Jackson walking down the street, and as he put it, and turning around and being relieved to see that there were young white people behind him. I thought, what an indication that is of black people fearing other black people, especially other young black people, and that comes out of the mouth of Jesse Jackson.
Let me put a little bit of this in the broader context of the other sorts of arguments that you've made in enough. They do grow out of the elements raised by Cosby, but they've really become your argument in the book enough. Of course, the issue of the culture of failure, a sense in the African American community that this is a culture of failure, and that failure is more likely and more inevitable than success in a world where Bill Cosby and I assume you believe that there are a myriad number of opportunities. You talk about the issue of reparations and the call among many African American leaders for reparations from the government of the United States for slavery. You talk about the dropout rates. You talk about the dismal condition of America's public schools and American cities. You talk about, as you just mentioned, criminality and the gangster culture that rap music has essentially perpetuated. You talk about teenage pregnancy and out of wedlock birth, essentially you put these things not in the context of racism and victimization as they have been portrayed now for probably 50 years anyway. You go back to the issue of W.E. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington and the issue of self-determination by African Americans and the strength and power that African Americans have traditionally had in this country, and that we need to go back to that era. We need to face up to the fact of individual responsibility. Talk about that issue of individual responsibility versus the challenge of society taking responsibility for what it has inflicted on African Americans.
Well, it's not an either-or situation, Walt, but it's the case that even as racism persists, and it's a reality in America as we know it today, it's also the case that there's greater level of opportunity for this generation of African Americans, for minorities in the country in general of every stripe, than ever before. There are more people of color in the country than ever before. It's now more than a third of the American population. The civil rights laws, the laws that have been passed going back 50 years to Brown, have opened doors. So we have higher levels of people graduating from high school, graduating from college. We have, in terms of income, not only the greatest wealth that African Americans have ever seen, it's now the richest, most affluent black population in the world. All of this is true, and yet there's this focus on grievance coming out of the mouths of Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. The only time you see them is they got to complain about racism. They got to complain about the lack of funding for some government program. They're telling you to support some candidate who's part of their coterie, but never, ever addressing the idea of the strength that exists within black America to address the problems of out-of-wedlock birth, of bad schools, high dropout rates, high levels of incarceration, the acceptance of crime that we've been talking about. None of those principal problems of this generation are addressed by these so-called leaders with any consistency and with any effectiveness. Now, you can go back in terms of the history. My favorite example to cite is Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, who has to learn how to read secretly because, of course, black people in slavery were denied that as a tool of oppression, denied the right for education to read and write. He learns how to do this. He becomes a voice. He builds himself up, builds his community. He goes and makes the argument to President Lincoln that black people should be allowed to wear the uniform of the Union Army so they can fight for their own freedom to end slavery, because he believes on that basis that you can say that black people who shed blood for this country deserve every right and privilege. I mean, and that's not the only example. You think of Booker T. Washington, who is well known for his uplift ideology, who said repeatedly, you know, we've got to create our own schools, we've got to build wealth in this community, we've got to educate our children. This was his contribution, and, you know, people oftentimes highlight the difference between W.E.B. Du Bois, who criticized Washington for not sufficiently believing in political agitation, but it was also Du Bois who said that Washington was the greatest of his generation, and we have to support him in every regard, when it comes to education, when it comes to building wealth, buying land and the like. And of course, Du Bois is famous for saying we need to educate the top tenth so that there's leadership within our community that can guide us and, again, uplift us and show us the path. This goes to Dr. King and the civil rights. You're saying the greatest thing about the civil rights movement was black people standing tall, organizing, building coalitions, strategizing. He said, a man can't ride your back unless it's bent. And in the civil rights years, we've stood tall and showed everyone what we can do, that we want to play on a level playing field. Well, how is it that that tremendous, inspiring legacy of people who had far less than we have in this generation and were operating under laws of strict segregation, if not slavery, how is it that they were able to mount such a challenge to the problems of their day, and yet in this day, all we hear about is victimization, racism? You know, it's contradictory. There's less racism, there's less of that, and more opportunity to create social change, and yet the leadership has turned its back, and in some ways is saying to young people, and I think this is maybe the most damaging, saying to young people, you can't make it in American society, don't try, you're just a victim.
I think that's
poisonous, Will.
Let me go back to one place. You talk about how essentially in the black community, these issues are not a secret among African Americans, that they're constantly talked about in private, and that there is, as you talked about, a kind of code by which there is an agreement that we do not talk about these things outside the race, because they will be used by white racists and by the white power structure to justify the fact that black people are to blame for their situation. How do you balance out that reality of the response, so to speak, from the larger society who may not have the best interests of African Americans at heart, with the need to openly have a public debate about these things that African Americans have been talking about among themselves for decades?
Well, two things to say, Walt. One is the charge was that Cosby was airing dirty laundry. I've seen some of that charge against me for this book. And, you know, my sense is, as Cosby responded, your dirty laundry gets out of school at 2:30 every day. It's using the N-word, walking up and down with its pants hanging off, you know, as if they just got out of jail and don't have a belt. You know, they're engaged in smoking dope and sexual behavior on the street and violence and fighting, and they've got guns. Everybody knows about the so-called secret or dirty laundry. So I don't know how it is that they think other people aren't, you know, they think people are so dense they're not seeing what's going on, that people aren't aware of the dropout rate.
Well, but I think some of it, one, is that it, you know, let's assume one-third of black America is poor, and obviously all of black America, poor black America, does not fall into this category, neither does all of middle-class and affluent black America. And so the characterizations that you use when you say they are walking with their pants without a belt on, they, who is they? And I know from, you know, some of my own work over the years that middle-class African Americans are sensitive to the fact that they are stereotyped and brushed with this label, and that what white Americans hear is they, meaning all blacks, as opposed to this subculture, so to speak, that Cosby and that you are focusing so strongly on.
Well, I don't know what people hear who are white, but I will say that I think it's pretty clear that in the black community there's no secret, and I think in the white community there's no secret when they look and they see these young people engage in that kind of activity, that they identify people in that way as self-defeating, as people who are engaged in a culture of failure. The larger point, though, in response to your question is this. There are always people who don't have your best interests at heart. They're racist and bigots out in the world. As I said earlier, racism persists in America. But the question is, are you therefore going to inhibit yourself from helping your community, from taking the steps that are necessary for the progress of your community, because you're in service to the bigots and the racists for all time? You're not going to have an important conversation about why your children are dropping out of school because you're afraid that some racist somewhere might make use of it? Look, the racists aren't there to help you. They don't have your best interest at heart. They never have. They never will. They were trying to stop your father and your grandfather, and you're going to shut up now and not do something to help yourself because you fear the racists? What about people who stood up to the violence from the racists, the dogs and the fire hoses? I think that's the tradition to follow, not one of cowering and being intimidated and silencing yourself in service to racists.
For those listeners who may or may not know, it might be significant to some of you to know that Juan Williams is an African-American journalist. For those of you who have not seen him on Fox News, do not know this. And so he speaks from, as they say, within the tent, which has become, you can hear from this conversation, part of the issue. Juan, we have a caller on line one who would like to ask a question.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to engage you in a number of levels, but I profoundly disagree with your analysis. I really do, and I hope you don't dismiss me as an attack dog because I might get a little angry about it, because you seem to be quite angry about it too. So I'll try to take some deep breaths and remain civil, but as a white American and lower class, I guess I would have to categorize myself, I wonder what world you live in when you say it's easier now for somebody to get ahead with a history over the last 30 years of pretty much either declining in the lower income range, the lowest quintile, and pretty much stable, which in cost of living terms and what there is in this world to acquire, that there's been a deterioration of the quality of life in this country, and that's cause for a mean and a hard scrabble fight at various levels. And I think African Americans get the worst of it in hiring practices. There's a lot of things still going on. The mortgage system is still in this town. We have a consent decree against a supposedly liberal community, and the solution was to build a school south of University being the landmark for the black north end of town, as it is in so many areas. They were going to build it on the west end of town to spur more growth for white landed classes out there. I mean, it's just outrageous. In the criminal realm, which you did refer to, I was cautioned to try to keep my remarks short, but you did bring up drug use. There is statistically higher drug use in the white community, not just because it's a larger majority, but there's just more drug use in the white community. But it isn't reflected in this town. There's in the same liberal community of Champaign, you can get a ticket for using drugs, and that's often how white college students are treated. But if you're African American and you get caught with a doobie, you know, you get the state charge, you go down the river.
So, caller, let's let Juan respond.
Please.
Yeah,
where I'm wrong here.
He gets the tenor, I think. Go ahead,
sure.
Juan.
Well, I think that you're confusing race and class in a gross fashion. Obviously, I think this is a very important point and one in which you and I agree. There's an increasing class divide in American society. It's harder to pay for higher education. It's harder to get a job, hold a job. It's harder to pay for health insurance. It's harder to buy a house, to own a car. All these things are just becoming more difficult in a society where there's an increasingly large share of wealthy people and even a growth in the upper middle class, and then a shrinking middle class and a larger pool of poor people. There's no question about that. But if you're asking me about levels of opportunity for black people, for Hispanics, Asians, Native Americans in American society today versus 50 years ago, there's a greater level of opportunity without a doubt. I've said to someone, you know, my dad couldn't imagine that he would be a senior correspondent for NPR or be on TV or writing books. It just wasn't possible for black people at that level, you know, in the frequency that you see it today. Today we have black people running everything from American Express to Time Warner, the biggest communications company in the country. You have a black Secretary of State. Things like that just are so unthinkable. It was unimaginable 50 years ago, and so there's a greater level of progress, and the statistics bear this out in terms of income, education level, all the rest. So there's just no question about the greater level of opportunity. Now, in response to what you said about the criminal stuff, again, yes, oftentimes I think jails are built as if it's an industry in terms of just eating people alive. And yes, as Walt and I were saying, sometimes you could make the case that, you know, there's greater drug use. I think there is greater drug use, no question about it, according to statistics, among whites. But look at the disproportionate share of blacks who are caught up in terms of being jailed for drug use. So you say, well, gee, what's that? Well, you know what? Cosby had something to say about this that I think is really on point. He said people talk about the disparate sentencing for people who, use crack cocaine versus powdered cocaine. And they say powdered cocaine is bought by the rich and the lawyers in their restrooms, in their office buildings, while it's the poor and oftentimes black people who are using crack cocaine on the street and getting caught up in the drug bust and the arrest. And he says, oh, there's so much energy put into this by black leadership. What about this disparity? Isn't it evidence of the discrimination? And he says, wait a second. Why isn't anybody in the black community's leadership saying it's wrong to use crack cocaine? That cocaine in this form, especially for poor people, devastates the individual, limits their functions, hurts their families, hurts their communities, makes it dangerous to walk the streets because some crackhead is going to mug you, creates crack houses that, again, cause crime in the community, makes the retail stores move out of the community because people can't come in there and use it. They got to have thick glass. Why doesn't someone say, stop this drug use? Why aren't we having marches against drug dealers instead of putting all this energy into some grievance and saying, oh, well, gee, maybe white people should have a higher sentence? Forget that. Let's deal with the real issues of the day as opposed to getting lost in this grievance victimization culture.
Juan, the caller does raise some important questions. So when he talks about, for instance, you know, the existence of discrimination in the mortgage market, and you know, we all know that, you know, schools are you know, the resegregation sort of American schools. We know that there is police profiling. We know that there is definitely discrimination in employment. We know that the demise of the industrial economy has undermined, as you pointed out, not only working class, high school and less educated people's jobs for African Americans, but for everyone. But certainly, because of the larger proportion of African Americans in that situation, it has hit them disproportionately. The emergence of the service economy, which you know, basically demands people with very little education to serve the needs of those with a great education. All those things are true, as I know you understand. And I will, you know, say all the things that you're saying are true at the same time. And, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald was famous for saying that the real measure of adulthood is the ability to keep more than one idea in your head at the same time. How do, in a culture, in a society where we seem unable to keep more than one idea in our head at the same time, how do we, Black America policymakers, find their way through this morass?
Well, first of all, in the subtitle of the book, you know, the book's title is enough, but the subtitle is The Phony Leaders, Dead End Movements, Culture of Failure, They're Undermining Black America, and What We Can Do About It. And the we is not limited to black people, Walt. It's black people, white people, it's rich people, poor people, it's conservatives, it's liberals, it's everyone. I think this is an American issue. It's an American problem. I mean, the white kids, in fact, are the biggest consumers of the hip-hop. And, you know, when you look at the dropout rate, it's now about a third for every, you know, for everybody in the country. And when you look at something like the out-of-wedlock birth rate, it's 25% in the white community. It's 50% in the Hispanic community. Of course,
we 70% in black community, right?
70, an alarming 70% in black America. So I think it's our problem, and it's what we can do about it. Now, you just said, you know, this business about, you know, two thoughts in your mind, and, of course, racism persists. I said all through this interview, I say in the book, racism is an issue. But here's the thing. With a greater level of opportunity as it exists today in black America, you know, 50 years after Brown, 40 years after the Civil Rights Act, with the fact that more doors are open than ever before, it's not to say every door is open, but with more doors open than ever before, where is the priority? What is the priority in terms of this moment for the civil rights movement in America? And my point to you is that at this point, if we are to make progress, if we're not to let that class divide leave a huge chunk of black America behind in the future of American society, we must say that we are preoccupied and going to make a priority of better schools, of doing a better job of repairing the black family, of doing a better job of dealing with the problems of crime and saying to young people, stay away from crime, stay away from the criminal industry, this jail industry, because it will absolutely cripple you in the future. So we want to have some very clear messages, and we want to talk to them about what you can do to help yourself, steps that you can take to empower yourself to succeed in America.
You know, Bill Cosby and you probably would not take nearly as much heat if it had only been a call and an accusation to poor black America to get your act together. The next step, of course, and Cosby went there when he said of black leaders who rejoice in your hopelessness because they have jobs mismanaging you. Moving on to the issue of black leadership and the idea that essentially your argument that black leaders claim kinship with poor blacks while they send their kids to suburban schools or even elite private schools because they need to claim this kinship to maintain legitimacy as leaders of black America, and that this is distorting the entire process of leadership in black America. That's when you guys really stepped into it.
I don't know what we stepped into. There's nothing there that's not true.
Well, that's what I mean. But the point is, explain that to me, Juan. I'm not saying it is or it isn't true, but explain it to me.
Oh, well, I mean, when Cosby says these are people who have jobs mismanaging you, I think they're people who make the case that there should be a bigger grant because there's a large pool of poor, uneducated, unemployed people, and therefore give me a grant, and they play on white guilt to do this. That seems to be an industry. Or they say, reelect me. I represent poor black people. We saw that down in New Orleans with Ray Nagin after the tremendous failures of his leadership in Hurricane Katrina, that compounded the, I think, even larger failures of the federal government. But, you know, people play racial politics and they play this authenticity card as much as the race card when it's convenient. But the fact is they don't say to people, here's what you can do to get out of poverty. Here's what, I mean, gosh, Walt, you and I both lived through the Marion Barry years in Washington, D.C. There's a black mayor that's literally videotaped smoking crack. He not only gets off, but he gets reelected. And then you say, well, why do people vote for this guy? What's going on? And he says, well, you know, he's the black mayor. It's our turn. I may not be everybody's, you know, cup of tea, but I'm right for you.
He's a bum, but he's our bum.
Yeah. I mean, and so what you see,
but that sounds very urban politics in mid-American century.
It comes down to sacrificing the whole notion of the struggle for racial justice and equality in America and making it into just the latest incarnation of a big city political machine. The Irish had their turn, the Italians had their turns, now it's the blacks' turn, and yes, there's going to be corruption, and it's all about the patronage and the jobs and the contracts.
And you're saying stop being so cynical?
I'm sorry?
Are you saying stop being so cynical and demand more?
Of course, but I mean, to my mind, there's always been, in terms of this African-American struggle, the reason that coalitions were formed, the reason that people, I think, throughout the world, I mean, from the Solidarity Movement in Poland to, you know, what happened in South Africa, everybody emulates the American Civil Rights Movement. Why? Because it was able to appeal to people in terms of justice and fairness and equality, the women's movement, Hispanic rights movement, gay rights. Everybody says, you know, that is the model. And yet some people want to just turn it into, oh, it's our turn. You know, it's our turn to take advantage of the system and milk the system and play on this notion that we're somehow serving this pool of poor people instead of trying to help those people out of poverty. And that's what this book, Enough, is about. Let's help people. Let's stop talking down to people and telling them they're victims. Let's say, you know what? We come from a grand tradition of creative, inventive leadership that finds a way around hurdles, sometimes hurdles that look so tall you can't even see the light of day, hurdles like Middle Passage and slavery. And yet black people have been able to surmount this by reaching deep within, you know, what we call soul, and finding a way. And yet, why are now this solitary focus on grievance? I think it's just tragic.
Juan, let me go to a caller on line two on a cell phone.
Hi, I'm going to try to make my comments within 1 minute, so it's going to be really fast. One is, I think one symptom of our problems is the fact that you needed to say that Juan was an African-American, so that you could say he had credentials in order to make the comments that he made. And those comments should be able to be made by anybody of any color. Secondly, he wanted. He just wasn't sure what white people hear. Well, I'll tell you what I hear. I watch all the political pundits on Sunday, and when I hear Juan speak, I hear the most articulate analysis of politics and social policy of anybody on the air. And I love his NPR reports, and he is a role model. The third point is, in speaking about role models, the only thing I didn't completely agree with was when you started with Douglas and you went to Martin Luther King. Malcolm X belongs in there. He had a change of heart in his attitude towards whites towards the end. He was always for blacks helping themselves, and he certainly wasn't a Farrakhan. He was just a very strong black man for black people. The other point is simply in terms of profiling, yeah, there's profiling, but this country's now changed its whole attitude towards profiling because of the so-called war on terror. And people are saying profiling isn't bad. The only point is you need to be careful when you act on a stereotype. Individuals are not stereotypes, but the stereotypes do give you some guidance. And the last thing I wanted to say is in discussing Marion Barry and saying how he got reelected, which sort of focuses on the poor black in Washington, D.C., we ought to address the fact that O.J. Simpson, when he was acquitted, they were showing on TV people, black people, at George Washington University, at colleges. These are kids who have succeeded, who have gone far beyond the ghetto, so to speak. And yet they have some kind of a problem with the white population that they don't mind that O.J. was guilty if they believed he was guilty. Most of the people said it didn't matter. It was them against the man.
Thank you, caller. Juan, I'm sure that you think that this man who thinks that you are the most articulate commentator on American political issues of the day is himself quite articulate.
Well, I wouldn't be that cynical about it, Walt. I appreciate his words. I think that when he's talking about these situations, you know, like the O.J. Simpson one, I think that what you see there is evidence of, again, people focus much more on the victim mentality than they are on justice. I think that's just corruption. I think that when, you know, you hear people talk about or make excuses for criminal behavior and say, well, you know what, the cops aren't fair, and there's police brutality, and there's police profiling. You have to stop and say, well, why are you involved in criminal activity in the first place? Why? I mean, you know, and the larger point that the caller makes, and I take this one to heart, Walt, is this business about, you know, who is allowed into the conversation. If we have a national crisis of this kind, why is it that Walt Harrington has to say that Juan Williams is black? Why is it not that smart, caring people, people who are out there looking at the social trends, are saying we have a crisis? And I tell you, we have a crisis, Walt, but numbers aren't there, you know, out of spite or aren't put up there by some racist. The numbers about dropout rates, the numbers about breakdown in family formation, the numbers about numbers of black people in jail, the 25% in poverty. Those are just hard facts, and I think that all of us have to get involved and shouldn't be intimidated, shouldn't be told, you know, you don't know what it's like to be black, or you don't know what it's like to be poor, or, you know, they find some reason. I mean, there are people who attack me. They want to say, oh, you know, you're the black Ann Coulter, in Al Sharpton's words. Or they say, oh, you look so middle class. You know, I say, you know, I don't want to stoop to your level, but just let me remind you something. Neither of my parents graduated from fifth grade. You know, I mean, and the biggest break of my life came when we got subsidized housing in my family. Are you kidding me? But, you know, it's that kind of thinking that leads, oh, no, you can't say anything, don't say anything, you're going to be attacked. It's just shut up and let a certain group of people manage this, and I just think it's wrong, Walt, because we can see that they've managed it, they've mismanaged it, or as Cosby say, they make money off of mismanaging it.
Of course, as you point out, we do live in the real world, and the very fact that Cosby was so listened to and had so much power and force was because of the standing that he had in the African-American community. I think you make it clear that very few other people could have gotten the carry on his message without the messenger being destroyed. It was because of his stature in the African-American community.
Well, I think that he's a celebrity for whites and blacks. I mean, obviously, The Cosby Show was the number one show on TV for several years running.
Juan, we have a caller on line three.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a couple of questions. Am I speaking loudly enough?
Yes, you are.
Okay. The first is, you said that, if I may paraphrase you, that blacks are responsible for their schools and they must be responsible for improving them. Is that substantially what you were indicating?
I don't remember saying that, but I do believe this, that if you are in a, your child is in a school, you as a parent have to take some responsibility for the education of your child. And in many cases, you have black mayors, black superintendents, black school boards, especially in the big cities. I live in Washington, D.C. That's certainly true in Philadelphia, New York, Detroit. This is just true. And to that extent, yes.
Well, here in Illinois, we have two Chicago communities. In one, upper middle class, largely white, they can raise enough money to pay $26,000 per student in their school system. We have another school community on the south side of Chicago. Again, it's not part of Chicago. It's an independent suburb, a large one, with one of the largest black communities in the city area or state. They can only raise $6,000. They do not have a tax base which will permit them to raise more than that. How are they going to improve their schools materially?
Good question. Juan?
Well, in most, I don't know about the specifics of that locality, but I'll tell you this, that in most big cities in America, the per pupil spending is higher than it is in the suburban schools. Now, the real argument there is about the higher cost of educating poor children with greater needs, and also about the fact that in the suburban schools, what you see is that sometimes parents will, you know, have all sorts of subsidies and everything from helping to pay for assistant teachers and counselors to computers and the like and school trips and all that. So sometimes that money doesn't count on the books.
Well, you haven't approached the question because this is not part of the Chicago system per se. It's a large Chicago suburb.
Well, let's seed and say that yes, there are disparities. Juan, what about that?
Here's what I say. I mean, I was going to finish the. I mean, the whole notion of inequities in terms of funding are things that the courts have been looking at. How you equalize funding opportunities within a state, and oftentimes that comes down then to the state government having to make some changes, amendments to the way education, for example, the way the schools are paid for in the state, whether it's property taxes, sales taxes, all the rest, to try to equalize it. But my larger point to you is that oftentimes it's not about the money. Oftentimes when people look at something like the achievement gap, they find that kids who are black and white kids going to the same suburban schools, same opportunities, what do they find? Again, a tremendous difference in terms of outcomes. Ability to read, ability to comprehend, ability to compute, tremendous differences. And when the sociologists go in and look at it, what do they find? Oftentimes, the priority is not placed on education, and to the contrary, that people who are trying to excel in an academic setting, who are black, are put down by their black peers as acting white. That, to me, comes more to the heart of the matter, and I say that fully appreciating that differences in funding are important. But I think what I'm focused on is what's going on in the home and what's going on in terms of communicating the priority of getting an education in this day and age, how important it is to go back to what a previous caller say, as you try to make it in a society that's riven by class division.
Thank you, caller. Juan, let's move on to the challenge of solutions. I mean, I suppose one of the arguments that you're really making is that the days of 40 acres and a mule are gone. There is not a political will to solve problems in the liberal mold that there was years ago, with more money, with more programs, and that we can argue for 20 or 25 or 30 years trying to create that political will and the public will to make that happen. But in that time, there are millions and millions of children who will be caught in the interim, and that right now we need, you want America to focus and black America to focus on those things that they can control and that they can solve. And that comes back to the real issue of personal responsibility.
I think so, Walt. You know, at the end of the book, what I say is, look, if according to the government, if you do four things, you can be almost assured that you'll never live a day in poverty in America. That is, graduate from high school, even the worst high school, but graduate from that high school. Get your high school degree, not a GED, but get a high school degree. Secondly, stay in the job market. Don't listen to people who say you're just flipping burgers or this job's demeaning. Take the job, stay with the job, build your resume, build your contacts so that you're aware when jobs open and then you're ready to succeed in that new job and move up the ladder. Third, don't have a child when you're a teenager or out of wedlock at any time. And fourth, don't get married until you're in your 20s. So if you do those things, Walt, if you don't get married until you're in your 20s and then don't have a child until you're married, graduate from high school, and stay in the job market, almost no chance of living in poverty. Now, that's a major piece of news when you have 25% of your population living in poverty. Why is that message of self-empowerment, things that people can do for themselves, not being delivered from the mountaintops at this moment?
And why?
I think that it's because they're too often this focus on victimization, on grievance, this whole notion of accepting this culture that I think is just, you know, this hip-hop stuff about, you know, to be a black person, to be authentically black, oh, you've got to portray yourself as downtrodden and contrarian and somehow, you know, you got to have a lot of attitude, fit this notion of bling-bling and violence and have a gun, and you know, the women have to dress like strippers to get into these videos or on TV. I think this is just such corruption, and yet that's what's being forced on our young people and into their minds, and it tells them they don't have an opportunity in this country. And I think that's just craziness when you look at all the immigrants that are coming in here because of the educational and economic opportunities. Why is it that our native-born children, especially those of color, who we know are up against it in a way that white kids aren't because of race, why aren't they being given good news and said, here's what you can do to help yourself. Look at the tradition, the inspiring traditions of black people throughout American history helping themselves. Let's make it real in this time at the start of this new century. That optimistic message is absent.
You name names in this book, and one of the institutions that you go after is black entertainment television, and you essentially say that they profiteered off of portraying African Americans in the most raunchy light. They promoted rap of the most sexist and misogynist type, and that portrayed the set of bling bling values that were the least reputable possibly, and that they did this because they could make more money. What about that?
I don't think there's any question. You look at the history of BET. I mean, they put on videos and beer ads and, you know, I mean, basically, then they had things like BET Uncut. It basically comes down to pornography. Snoop Dogg, you know, the hip-hop people say, oh, gosh, you know, the critics are all censors. They're old fogies. Look at what's come of Snoop Dogg. He's now basically the biggest pornographer in America. His porn videos are the biggest sellers. And he's got things like doing things like, you know, leading women out on leashes on the stage at awards. And then you have this guy, Flavor Flav, and the Flavor of Love on TV. And they're talking about, you know, black women defecating. And it's just the most horrible stuff. This is what's held up as authentically black. This, I mean, it's bad enough that it feeds white stereotypes, racist stereotypes. But the idea that it gets into young black minds.
And you pointed out that MTV, for instance, the MTV would never be able to carry things like this. But again, because of BET's standing as a black station, it was able to carry these kinds of products.
And did it and repeated it. And now, of course, it's in the hands of Viacom. And I must add that the last thing, that Flavor of Love thing, that's happening now on MTV. I mean, it's just criminal. And it's just become accepted as, and treated as normal. But I think that if, you know, the Ku Klux Klan was out there, if this was W. Griffith, you know, Birth of the Nation, then people would see it for what it was. This is racist propaganda intended to demean and belittle black people.
And 70% of it is bought by white males, mostly teenagers.
Yeah, so what's it saying to them? You talk about feeding racism and feeding caricatures. That's the struggle.
We have a call on line one, if you can do it quite quickly, please.
I'm having trouble maintaining my focus because I've been holding for so long. Just a couple perspectives. One is that this whole idea of competing for victimization is something that seems to be a human characteristic. And I agree with you completely, but I also see it happening in all kinds of other situations. Whether you're a teacher in school and if you catch one kid doing something, the other one says, well, you didn't catch so-and-so. And just in the newspaper, it was landlords saying of keeping up their properties. Another thing is that a friend of mine would often tell me that, and this is a woman who was in her 60s until she died 2 years ago, that even, it's not just young people, it's people of all ages who are African American are told by their friends, you're acting too white. She said, I don't understand it. He said, if I do anything that's successful, I'm acting too white. At the same time, she would use the N-word and the ho-word periodically. I didn't say that quite right. And I would say to her, why are you doing that? And she said, well, when I use those terms with my kids or my friends, it makes them strong. I said, why does making somebody smaller make them stronger? I was never able to get that across to her. Now, this is something that clearly was deeply, deeply ingrained in her. And I'm glad that your book is out. I think as with anything, if you're going to change people's attitudes, it's got to come from lots of different directions in lots of ways, because the people who need to read your book may not be reading it.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it's really grating on me, you know, that people attack it, make it a personal attack against me, but they don't want to deal with the facts. And I think that whole victimization mindset that you just talked about, you know, it's just that much more deleterious in a black community, especially poor black community, where people have to take steps to help themselves. They can't wait for the next great charismatic leader, the next Dr. King. They can't wait for the next government program or the next mayor that's going to help them. I think, gosh, right now, people have to get help either from themselves or somebody, but they've got to start with themselves. They've got to look for opportunities to rise up. And we're talking here about self-empowerment and not accepting the N-word, which I think is, you know, part of the whole self-hate thing that goes on, not accepting people putting you down, but you know what, standing up for yourself, believing in yourself, believing in their traditions and that black people have a proud history in this country. That's what I'm saying, and you're right, you know, the kids all play victim, and sometimes you think, you know, everybody thinks that the way to win in this country is to be the bigger victim. But I don't think it's a smart tactic if you are caught in the grips, in the chilling, paralyzing grips of poverty, because I think going forward it's going to be even harder to get out.
Juan, I want to thank you. I want to thank the callers. The book is Enough, The Phony Leaders, Dead-End Movements, and Culture of Failure That Are Undermining Black America and What We Can Do About It by Juan Williams. Thanks a lot, Juan.
And Walt, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.